Now, if you are or have been with us, you know what book we're in, so you can go ahead and turn to the book of Exodus. And we're in Exodus chapter 14. Let's read Exodus chapter 14. We'll read through the whole chapter so we can get a look at the whole account that we'll be talking about this morning. Remember, just in 13, God has given in verse 21, the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. So they are making haste in their fleeing out of Egypt by day and by night. Okay, they're being guided by a pillar of fire and a cloud. And of course, God is the one guiding and directing them. Verse 14, or chapter 14, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. Very specific instructions here given by God. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. And I, God, will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. The children of Israel did as God commanded. They camped where he told them to camp. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled or given them the slip, they were running away, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, what is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, all the king's horses and all the king's men, and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent. The Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the angel of God who was going before the host of Israel moved and went in behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them, in front of them, and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt, who were pursuing, and the host of Israel. And there was a cloud and the darkness. and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst. They went forward into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, at last 3-4 hours of night, the early morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily in the mud. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And the Egyptians fled into it. The Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Of all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so the people feared, reverently respected the Lord. And they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. The crossing of the Red Sea, probably, undeniably, one of the most famous, if not the most famous, Bible story ever. And we get to discuss it this morning. I want to start off by just pointing out a very obvious fact, but sometimes we lose sight of it. One is, the hero of this story is not Moses. The hero of this story is not Israel. The hero of the story is God. He is the hero. But we study through a passage like this, and we look at the Egyptians, we look at the Israelites, but we look at them to learn from their good or bad examples of submission to the Creator God and his will. So as we talk through this, this is the format we're gonna do this in. It's like we're gonna comb through the chapter. And the first time we comb through, we're gonna talk about the Egyptians, okay? And look at this account from the Egyptians' perspective, then we will do the Israelites, and then God, and then we'll close with just a thought for us. But there are thoughts for us all through, so don't check out, all right? From the Egyptians' perspective, what have they done? That's what they're asking themselves. What have we done? Have you ever thought through a decision, one of those big decisions? It's coming up, you stay up at night, you're doing stuff during the day, but that's what's on your mind. You're thinking through, processing, trying to look at it from all the angles you need to. Okay, and then you make the decision, and then shortly after that, the ramifications of that decision start to hit you, and you ask yourself, did I make the right choice? What have I just done? That is where the Egyptians are. Something has brought them to this point. They have faced the wrath of the Creator God, the God of the children of Israel, who they have been oppressing and subduing. God has said, let my people go, and they have defiantly said no. And so God has brought them through plague after plague after plague, and they have continued to say no until finally he brings the death of the firstborn, and that is the straw that proverbially breaks their backs at that moment, and Pharaoh says, okay, get out of here. Get out of here. Leave. So, the children of Israel, they go through and they plunder Egypt, and then they run. They're making a mad dash out of Egypt. And so the Egyptians here, they're tracking what's going on. The children of Israel are leaving. I mean, commentators say it's upwards. It could have been up to 2 million people who are exiting out of Egypt. Okay, just a huge number of people who are leaving. And so they don't go quietly. It's pretty easy to track their movements. And it's obvious as they leave, chapter 13 says they don't go through Philistia, the land of the Philistines. They stay out of there because God wants to protect them from possible war. So then they go by route of the wilderness, but then God directs them to go camp in a place that, from a military standpoint, this is a dumb decision. And Egypt is watching and tracking the movements, and word gets back to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh goes, they don't know what they're doing. They just placed themselves in a position that we could go and get them back. They're regretting their decision, and now the opportunity presents itself. They can chase down the children of Israel, and with relative ease. Where are they going to go? They're camped next to the sea. Are they going to run out there? We've got them. And so Pharaoh hardens his heart, and he begins to gather the forces, and they chase down the Israelites. Now, even in this, as they're pursuing, there should have been some red flags popping up. As they approach the children of Israel, what happens? The cloud, the pillar of fire, the cloud removes itself from the front of the children of Israel. And it says they're within eyesight, right? The back end of the children of Israel can see the Egyptians coming. So this cloud that led Israel to that point removes itself from the front and goes to the back. And I cannot tell you exactly what this looked like because commentators are all over the board on what exactly happens here. But all we can definitively say is God places this cloud in between the pursuing forces of Egypt and the relatively helpless children of Israel. A cloud is there. And it keeps them from advancing in on the children of Israel through the beginning part of the night. Coincidence? If you're an Egyptian? Just another little sign that maybe this isn't the right thing to do. Maybe God is against us, but their hearts have been hardened over time after time of rejecting. And so what happens? God parts the Red Sea. They watch 2 million people walk through on dry ground and enraged. That's what's driving them. Their minds are blinded by anger and pride in opposition to God. And so they are pursuing the children of Israel to capture them back, and nothing is going to stop them. Not even one of the craziest miracles, craziest supernatural acts of God that you can imagine, the sea being parted and the ground being dried so that the people of God can walk through. You think at this point, if you're an Egyptian, you approach this, another chance, right? Maybe this isn't the right thing to be doing. Maybe God's doing something with these people. But blinded by their anger and pride, they push on to capture God's people, and they run down into this valley of water, water built up on both sides. They're pursuing after the children of Israel, and God clogs up the ground. He lets the ground go from being dry to thick, nasty mud. If you've ever had the opportunity to be in mud like this, where you get your foot stuck and you're just like, the more you wriggle, the more stuck it gets, right? I was duck hunting on the Gulf of Mexico one time, and I got into a spot on the Gulf in waders where I got up to my waist in mud, and I could not get myself out. It seemed like the more I struggled, and a panic sets in when that happens, and you have to fight to keep yourself from going crazy. The panic sets in for these Egyptians as they are plowing through the sea on dry ground, and all of the sudden, they're not moving, and their tires are sunk deep. The wheels literally fall off the operation as they're charging. God makes this happen, and a panic sets in. And then, from the other side, God tells Moses, raise your arms, and God sends the waters crashing down on these Egyptians. And every single one of them dies. It's a sobering moment when you stop to think about it, that these men who had been shown the mercy of God over and over and over had opportunity after opportunity to turn back to God, and the day of the wicked ended here. God will be glorified. You will bow. Every knee will bow to him. So for us, don't presume on the mercy of God. A commentator named Wagner points out, Pharaoh and Egypt are ever speaking witnesses of the danger of neglecting the first proffers of mercy and of the sure end of that presumption which leads sinful man to oppose the will of God. So the end of a man presuming on the mercies of God, taking the mercy of God for granted, that I have been allowed to live another day and I haven't suffered the consequences of my sin today. I haven't been obliterated by God today because he has withheld his hand. And man presumes on that. We take it for granted. The end of that, presuming on the mercies of God, is a man who is opposed to the will of God. In a chilling reminder in Proverbs 11:21, be assured that the wicked will not go unpunished. You will be punished for your wickedness. The mercy of God extended will not go on forever. And we don't even want to get close to this level of hardness. How do we not get close to this level of hardness, of presuming on the mercy of God like this? And you say, well, you know, I don't really say no like the Egyptians did. But we do. We do. The areas of sin in our life where God's will is one way and our will is another way, and we say, no, I'm going to go on with this. I think I'm going to keep going with this. This feels better. It's easier. We need to pray and ask God to reveal where we are proud and arrogant, where we are self-dependent. And instead of harboring sin and bitterness and pride and arrogance, we need to be proactive in saying, God, look into me. Like the psalmist said, search me. Look at my heart. Know my thoughts. Find, search out any wicked way in me. And of course, the purpose is of that is as he reveals those things, then we humbly bow and confess and forsake, and we honor God in that. We bring him glory through humbly bowing and saying, I'm wrong. You're right. God will be glorified. He was going to be glorified either way in this. He mercifully gave opportunities to the Egyptians to glorify him through humility and submission. And when rejected, he was glorified by crushing his enemies. Verse 4, he says, they will know that I am the Lord. They will acknowledge this. Verse 17, I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. Verse 30, Israel sees this. They see the Egyptians dead and washing up onto the seashore, and God is glorified through their response. God will be glorified. And in this case, God is glorified through crushing the Egyptians. Two will come through again, the children of Israel. The chapter here ends, like I just mentioned, with the children of Israel seeing what has happened to the Egyptians, and they fear in verse 31. They bow, they believe, they see who God is, and they have faith in him. But it doesn't start that way. Go back to the beginning of the chapter, right? God's leading them and guiding them through a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. God leads them to the point that they're at. And then when they see, they look up and they see the Egyptians pursuing them, what happens? They fly off the handle. They lose it. They're gripped in verse 11 by what? Or actually, verse 10, it says, they feared greatly. Their response here, as they scream out these accusations at Moses, who is God's representative, so they're not just screaming at a man, they're screaming these accusations at their God. Their response in this moment is sinful. And you say, well, that seems a little hard. I mean, I can sympathize with them, right? It feels kind of unfair to put them in this position. I understand why they said what they said, because I probably would have said the same thing. And the point is that our natural human response is not a faithful response. Our natural response is not a response that is full of faith in God. And their unbelief is pointed out and condemned by Scripture. So I want you to look over at Psalms 106 really quick. Psalms 106, verse 6. David, in describing all of this, he says, both we and our fathers have sinned. We have committed iniquity. We have done wickedness. Our fathers, when they were in Egypt, they did not consider your wondrous works. They did not remember the abundance of your steadfast love, but rebelled by the sea, at the Red Sea, but rebelled by the sea. At the Red Sea, their response here, David condemns as sin. And we do well to recognize this type of a response is sinful. These people, just a chapter before, they were told to remember all that God was doing on their behalf in chapter 13. You see, the Egyptians weren't the only ones forgetting the miraculous power of God. God's people in this moment are forgetting the miraculous power of their God. The Egyptians were blinded by rage and pride. The children of Israel are blinded by fear and ultimately pride. They forget what God has done for them, why they're there in the first place, that the cloud that God gave them to lead them, that's what they were following. God put them right there. They forget that in this moment, and then they begin to claim that their way would have been better than God's, who had led them to that point. He got them into this mess. It would have been better if they would have stayed in Egypt and remained slaves. We told you so, God. I told you, Moses, you remember this? You made us stink in the nostrils of Pharaoh. You remember that whole thing? Man, it would have been better if we would have just stayed in Egypt instead of being brought out here to die in the wilderness. It's pride. Do you hear it? Arrogance. Chuck Swindoll says in commentary over verses 11 and 12, isn't it remarkable what a predicament will do to your proud, independent spirit? A predicament to knock you out of your self-dependent routine. Does your faith in God change how you respond in those moments, in those long days, weeks, months, years. A commentator named Stephen Brammer said, "The suffering of Israel in the wilderness, as recorded in 14 through 18, 14 being our chapter here, the purposes of the wilderness suffering," and this was before they reached the Mount Sinai, "these purposes varied, and here are a few of them. God wanted to test them, to see if they would trust him. He wanted to challenge them to be his people, to live differently than all the other nations so that all peoples would know he is the Lord. He wanted to teach them how to worship him in a manner different from that of other nations. All of this, 14 right here, occurs in the God-planned circumstances of suffering and subsequent necessary trusting. God was doing this to bring them to a point of trusting him. And it raises a thought I've heard projected many times, contemplating how if God is the mastermind of all of this, well, isn't this kind of sadistic? He's deriving pleasure from inflicting pain on his people, suffering on his people, putting them in a tough situation so that he can receive glory. So God is like the ultimate troublemaker here. He creates the problem and then provides the solution to make himself look good. You know, does God have the hero syndrome here? We ask this question, phrased like this, when we view what is happening through our finite, proud minds and hearts. We forget our place. We forget who he is. Remember, God is God. He created all of this. He created us. We are the creation that rebelled against him. And in that moment, he didn't just destroy us. He instead mercifully promised a way back to him. And then he casts Adam and Eve out of the garden in mercy to keep them from the tree of life. Because if they ate of that, they'd live forever. So it's mercy to remove them from there and that temptation. And he gives them new commands and allows them to continue to live and sin against him. Remember, left to our own devices, what do? We, every single time, rebel against God. Left to our own devices, every single time, we are like Babel. We don't need you, God. Every single time, left to our own devices, we are self-dependent and we turn from God. We will do what we want. But God, in his mercy, places us in situations that strip us of all of the possible things that we place our hope and joy and peace and satisfaction in. God, in his mercy, places us in trials where everything is stripped away and all we have left is our greatest need. God knows our greatest need. And it's in his mercy. He brings us to positions where we have to turn to him, the author and finisher of our faith, the one who has brought us here. He's doing this for us, giving us chances to turn and magnify him so that others will in turn turn to him and more people will glorify him and find what we were created for, a relationship with God. And I don't want to flippantly refer to these trials because my heart breaks to see and hear of the trials that we face. But God is working out his plan and we see it evidenced here. We must believe it. We must have faith that he's working out his plan for our good and his glory. So it's remarkable that at the beginning of this chapter, David condemns the children of Israel for their lack of faith. But then the end, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 29, commends the children of Israel for their faith. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea. So wait, what's the point here? They're being condemned for their lack of faith, but the end of the chapter, they have faith. And they're commended for it. The point being that just because at the onset or even in the middle, we don't have faith, every day we're living and breathing, God is still giving us an opportunity to turn to him and to believe and trust in him. And that's exactly what the children of Israel do. They start out the chapter without faith, but as they see what's going on and God powerfully separates the sea in front of them and dries out the ground for them to walk through, they have faith. Now you say, how would that take faith? How would that take faith? How did the children of Israel exhibit faith in this moment? They had to start walking. They had to step out into the sea that they just saw parted. How long is it going to stay up? Do you know? Do we have to, is this like a 50-yard dash? Or like, are we timed here? Like, how many minutes do we have? What do we, no, they have all these people who have to walk through. It took faith to take your young, to take your elderly, and say, God's opened this way. We're going to walk. And the children of Israel commended for their faith. Literal steps of faith as they walk through on dry ground. I want to close just with a couple of moments of considering God, the hero of all of this. You know, if it was up to us, you know, I probably would have gotten the big one. Okay, part the ground. I mean, part the sea, right? Make sure that's open so they can walk through. But God has the details down, okay? I don't know if I'd have remembered to dry out the ground, right? God has it. He's got everything worked out. He holds the water up for the perfect amount of time. He dries out the ground so they can all with speed walk through. He is working out his plan. He's not limited by the things that we see as limitations. We can't walk through that. We're stuck here. God's not stuck. He's going to come through on his promises. All of creation answers to him. I'm so thankful for the song we sung, Our God is an Awesome God. There's another version of that that my family has listened to, a rapper named R. Swift, okay? The lyrics that he wrote, and he uses the chorus, Our God is an Awesome God, the same one we sung this morning. He uses that as the chorus, but the lyrics in the middle there, one of them, he just says, he reigns, Lord, firearms, B-2 bombers, I added that. Anything, it's too short to aim for him. Call him extremist. He leaks Katrinas, and this was written in 2009. So Hurricane Katrina, he leaks Katrinas when he's brainstorming. It's no effort for him. This whole thing here, the storm, the miraculous storm that blows throughout the night and separates the sea. God wasn't thinking about this. It wasn't hard. He didn't move his pinky to make this happen. It wasn't work for our God. Our God is an awesome God, and he reigns. He is over everything. He is a beast. His wrath is the sound of a lion roaring. Since he's topped by none, these are the lyrics of his song, I'm on hip-hop's front line screaming from the top of my lungs. Our God is an awesome God. He reigns from heaven above with wisdom, power, and love. Our God is an awesome God. He's screaming this. But man, we're sophisticated. You know, I think maybe we need a little bit more of this type of excitement, right? We cheer when the touchdown is scored and the home run gets hit. You know, the three-pointer gets hit on the buzzer, and the crowd goes wild. We in church, we sit here, and we read about God separating the sea through an awesome storm and his people walking through on dry ground and crashing it down masterfully on all of his enemies, and we go, amen. And heaven forbid somebody gets excited, because then we're like, hey, quiet down over there. We start clapping for all these other things. We need to be impressed by God. We can be. And man, the response in 15 next week, when they start singing at the top of their lungs, that's what we need. And I can't, just pointing this out, I can't make this happen. Just being aware that God needs to impress us more, and we've lost how awesome our God is. The Holy Spirit needs to reawaken our minds as we read through passages like this, stories that we have heard since we were a child, and we need to have our jaws on the floor and our hands together in praise and excitement for how awesome our God is. When we get news about stuff like last night, bombs flying, it's tempting to get worried here. It's tempting to start wondering as we see the muscles flexing of man. Nuclear power, bunker busting bombs, the threat of World War III. God is not sitting in heaven going, oh no, the snowball's rolling out of control. He is an awesome God, and we, his people, we have to trust him. We can believe him. What he said he will do, he will accomplish. What has he said he will do? What has he said he will do for his people? He's already told us the times are going to get worse. You will suffer persecution. You will face trials that will grow your faith and enduring patience. You're going to do all of these things. So don't lose faith. In these moments, as you go throughout this week and you interact with people, how is your faith in God going to flesh out in your conversations with people as people are wringing their hands and worried over what they're watching on the news? We have a God who is in control of all of this. Keep the faith.